Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of All Brother, a podcast about Salford / Manchester's legendary musical institution, The Fall. Each week we invite along a guest to chat about their experience and memories of the group. You can find us at Spotify, Apple and all the usual suspects, but we're hosted at play.acast.com/s/All Brother. All episodes are also available on YouTube. Search for the All Brother podcast and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. This week we're joined by musician, In Spiral Carpet, DJ and all-out Manchester legend, Mr. Clint Boone, who discusses his fascinating career and his many interactions with The Fall. Hope you enjoy it.
Right, welcome to the latest episode of All Brother, The Fall podcast with me, Paul Hanley, and my much more famous brother, Steve.
Give over.
we're delighted to welcome somebody along today who's kind of synonymous with Manchester music, right from the early days of 76, and he's appeared in sort of every kind of movement since. He's also worked with Marquis Smith and very nearly worked with The Fall, but we'll get on to that. So I'd like to say hello to you. Welcome, Clint Boone.
How are you doing, brother? Okay. Nice to speak to you both.
Yeah. You well?
Yeah, really good. And I think you're both equally famous in my mind, so...
I did have to explain who I was before we started recording, if you remember, but never mind. So, You were at the Pistols at the Electric Circus, is that right? You must have been very young then to be coming from Oldham all the way to Colliers.
Yeah, it was December of 76, so it wasn't the Lesser Free Trade Hall gig. That happened in July, didn't it?
Yeah.
But I was at college in Rochdale, I was at the Art College in Rochdale, and I was fortunate that at that time, I mean, you know, late 75 and then through 76... We used to work in an open plan studio in the college. You know, we didn't have a workshop, and we all just had our own spaces, and we had a communal record player. So people would bring in records. And I remember when I started at Art College, it was people bringing in stuff like Steely Dan and the Eagles and stuff that I didn't really resonate with. You know, I was more into my 50s rock and roll. But then through the summer of 76 or early 76 through to summer, we started getting these new records that were like, really edgy, and it wasn't called punk at the time. It was just, you know, it'd be a band called The Damned, or it'd be, you know, this band from New York called The Ramones, and these records started appearing in the common room, if I can use that term, or the studio. And it was just that record player. I can vividly picture it now as well. I could probably draw a decent picture of the actual record player. It was such a central part of everything we did at Art College. And these records, if you brought your record in, you knew that it was going to die in that room, because, you know, there'd be some guy working with ceramics, you know, pottery, and he'd turn the record over and that would be the first two tracks dead with all the clay and the grease, whatever. You know what I mean? So, and it was just that you knew that if you brought a record in, you were sort of sacrificing it to the cause. And I remember when the Pistols brought out the first single, that was like just every day we'd be going off to the record shop in Rochdale to buy a new copy of it, you know, well, every week. It was just like your records would get trashed, but the shared experience that we got from that was like such a massive... part of that transition from being a 50s rock and roll kid to becoming, you know, right in the heart of the punk movement. So
it's a good job you didn't know how much them Anarchy in the UK and EMI would be worth today.
I know. You know what? I've still got those somewhere in my. I'm a hoarder, me, so I've got boxes of stuff all over the house and in storage and that. And somewhere I've got an original Anarchy in the UK poster. Wow. You know, now they're worth a lot of money now, and I'm sure at some point when I'm going through all these boxes, I'm going to find it and straight on eBay.
That's your retirement fund right there, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
We were talking about this yesterday about. Because there's that thing with the Joy Division thing now and what have you, and there was an auction where Ian Curtis's passport photo that he took for the tour of America that never happened went up for auction, and what's it worth, Steve?
7,000 was the bid.
Oof.
You want to look after that poster.
Look after that bloody poster, yeah, Christ.
Well, I've got passport photos of Noel Gallagher that are original, as they were when you used to get four on a sheet.
Yeah,
like I remember going. There used to be a little photo booth place on Oxford Road. It's a little camera shop, but they used to take your passport photos for you. And I remember going in with Noel on several occasions. You know, getting photographs for forthcoming European tours. You know, for your visa or the American trip that was coming up. And we'd always swap, like, because you only needed two or three for the for the trip. And we'd always swap the last one. I'd give him my copy, and you know, he'd give me his. And I've still got some of these original. Passport photos of Noel Gallagher. I'm not saying he's up there with Ian Curtis yet.
But make you hang on to them.
Yeah.
Well, it was on Instagram, that was.
Absolutely, wasn't it? Can I go back to that period, though? I didn't answer your question about the Electric Circus gig. So that period of being at Art College, and I was also fortunate that one of the guys at Art College with me, he's in the year above me, but very much part of our team, was Phil Diggle. Brother Steve was in this band called Buzzcocks, and he'd always be talking to us. Do you know Phil, either of you?
I don't know.
Very charismatic character.
Craig's, isn't he, Paul?
Yeah, I think he did know Craig, yeah, because Craig's from Oldham as well, wasn't he?
And they've got a sister, haven't they, that Craig knew.
Right.
Yes.
But Phil was very charismatic, great artist. I mean, to this day, he's a very well-known artist based in London. And he'd always do this thing where he was a smoker, but if he didn't have a cigarette in his hand, he'd still have the mannerisms of smoking a cigarette. And he'd be like, oh, guys, listen, our kids' band, Buzzcocks, are doing a gig tonight. You should really come and check them out, you know. And it was like it was him who sort of tipped us off to the Electric Circus gig that was happening, where the Buzzcocks were supporting Johnny Thunder's Heartbreakers, The Clash, and The Sex Pistols.
Wow. Thursday
9th of December it was. So we went straight from Art College. Literally, you know, finished our Art College work for the day, got on a bus down to Colliers and watched this gig. And
risked your life getting in.
Risked our life. I didn't realise on the night. I think it was more subsequent visits to the Electric Circus. I think on that night, I was just in awe of the moment. You know, we were going downtown. We're all in our... We had these sort of outfits that we designed. Before punk, we used to go to the local Oxfam shop in... Rochdale, and we'd buy like dinner suits, you know, like old man's dinner suits, black, and then we'd paint the collars in white PVA glue and the pocket flaps and the cuffs. So we had this quite unique look that was our thing that art students did back then. So it wasn't part of punk, it was before punk. We were like, we're art students, we want to just look like a bunch of twats, you know, that's what we did.
Well, he was on that, wasn't he, Phil Diggle? He did like Buzzcock shirts and stuff. He did that secret. I remember Steve Diggle had this great. Sort of a Buzzcock shirt, the pink thing with the, like, a bit like the Love You More cover.
Yeah.
Steve Diddler done for him. And if I've ever coveted anything from anybody in a band, I wanted that shirt. I mean, it wouldn't fit me, like.
but yeah, so I was just fortunate that moment in time that I was part of turned out to be a real piece of history. Not as much a piece of history as the Lesser Free Trade All gig, but to me, to see the Pistols and the Clash on the same bill, you know, for like £1.50. I think it was £1.50 to get. It might be £1.20. To be there on that night and to realise in the moment that this was my life changing, literally in front of my eyes, because this was the point where I realised that I didn't need to just dream about being a pop star, you know, because that's what I'd done until that point.
I was going to ask you, have you had thoughts of being in a band before that then?
I had. I mean, I'd thought more about, you know, from being... You know, 7, 8, 9 year old, I just wanted to be like Elvis Presley. So it wasn't even a band. It was like, I just wanted to be like Elvis, you know what I mean? So, but I didn't do anything about it. I didn't try to learn to play any instruments or anything because I think I was convinced that I didn't have it in me. I didn't have a decent voice. I've, you know, as you know, I'm from Oldham. I've got this bloody impediment, haven't I? The Oldham accent. So it's like I didn't really think I was ever going to pull it off, and I didn't really do anything about it. You know, I didn't learn to play an instrument. And it's just, you know, that night, but seeing punk happen and be, you know, seeing Steve Diggle on stage, who's, you know, my mate's brother from lives on Broadway. It's like, I could probably do this. I could probably give this a shot. And that's what happened. I mean, within months, I dropped out of college, because until that point, the plan was that I would have gone off to university or whatever, you know, art uni, whatever they used to call it back then, to do a degree and, you know, maybe become a teacher or, you know, an artist in my own right, whatever. But it was just everything just made sense that night. It was like, I know where I'm going now. I dropped out of college. I think by Easter, I dropped out of college. Got a job in a local steel factory just to earn some money so I could start getting equipment, you know, buying music gear and going to gigs, et cetera. And just started being, I put myself in that world of live music, you know, because of punk. And that led on to everything that I do to this day is because of that moment, really.
Yeah. So, while we're on the Electric Circus, you were at the last night of the Electric Circus where the Fall were on, weren't you? You were at that gig.
Yeah, and that's where I'm convinced that was the first time I'd seen the Fall. I think it was quite early gig for them, wasn't it? That was October 77. And I think they'd only started gigging in summer of 77. So a relatively early gig. But I wasn't aware of the Fall. And that night, I remember when they came on stage, it was like, this is different. This is because I think punk had got into a bit of a rut. If you know, there was like certain cliches that all the bands had. You know, they're all angry. They're all a bit scuffy. They'd have slogans written on the shirts, and you know what I mean. There was a uniform, and there was a way of dancing. You know, if you're in a band, this is how you moved. And when the Fall came on, it was like, fucking hell, this is like, they look like, he looks like he should be in a cabaret band. Yeah. You know, singing fucking Crackling Rosie or something.
Oh, was that a nice shirt on, Mark? Didn't he?
Satin shirts. I remember he really influenced me because I started wearing satin shirts after I first saw him, and I've still got most of them here because, you know, my early in Spiral gigs, I wore a lot of shirts that were very Mark Smith style.
Yeah, how much stuff have you got in your house?
Oh, you should see it, Mark. I'm sat here. I'm glad this isn't a video one because I'm just surrounded by boxes. And I mean, honestly, I've got stuff here dating back to the, like, songs that I wrote in the early 1970s into a cassette machine
and
all that.
Me and Paul are the complete opposite, aren't we?
Feng Shui?
Yeah, that's it, yeah. There's nothing to move about. I've got nothing, mate. Absolutely nothing.
Was it Feng Shui? Did you both go bankrupt?
I've never in sold stuff. It.
Right.
No.
I've never had anything to sell. I would have sold it if I'd had it, but no, I'm not big on stuff.
Right. You know what? I think with me, I'm not materialistic. I never have been, but I've always been one to document what's going on. Yeah. So I've got a lot of photographs. I'm looking here.
More of it, yeah.
Yeah, I've got boxes here of slides, you know, transparencies and cassette tapes and DAT tapes, Betamax audio tapes. And I've just saved everything that we ever did. I remember Bill Wyman used to be like that with the Stones, didn't he? Yeah. And I think I've turned into a bit of like the Bill Wyman of the Inspirals, I think.
Somebody has to do it, don't they? That's the thing. I'm not saying that. I wish I had. There's loads of stuff I wish I'd kept.
Yeah.
But just to have it, not because it's worth money or anything, just to see it, you know.
Yeah.
Somebody had, funnily enough, somebody was put on their Twitter today a picture of the T-shirt from the last gig I did with the Fall, which was at Royal Court. It was New Order, the Smiths.
Yeah, from Manchester.
And John Cooper Clarke. And somebody, it was the guy from Memorial Device. This is, and he's got the T-shirt. And I said, I'd really like that T-shirt. I don't want to buy it off you, by the way, but I would. That's my last gig of the Fall. But I mean, there's loads of stuff like that I wish I'd kept.
Yeah, I've got it all here. I mean, going back to Mark's dress that night, he had shiny shoes on as well, which was just not a done thing in punk. No. I mean, I know the Jam were a bit modish, so they had the elements of that. But yeah, Mark just, he looked different the way he was dressed. He danced. He had a completely unique way of moving. He wasn't trying to be macho. He had like a little skip in his step. And
That little dance he used to do. He kind of dropped that pretty quick, didn't he?
It was more like it's more like setting the ground for what Jarvis Cocker ended up doing in terms of the way he moved. Very, you know, quite camp at times, but
definitely.
And you know, and then on top of all that, these incredible songs that they had. You know, the first generation of Fall songs, like Dresden Dolls and Industrial Estate. They had. Was it A Student that became A Fascist? Or no, it was A Fascist that became A Student. Right. And it's just these songs are like just incredibly catchy. And not that I understood what was going on about with a lot of them, but to me, it was just this, even though it was the last night of the Electric Circus, and I was gutted that it was the end of an era. You know, I was already mourning it in a way that I did when the Hacienda went later on the boardwalk. Yeah. It was the last night of the circus, and I knew that this wasn't a good moment.
No.
But when I saw the fall, it was like, but this is probably the next chapter for me. And it was.
I mean, it's so good, that album that came out from that.
Yeah,
the 10-inch one, the blue one.
Yeah, the last night electric. Yeah. Short Circuit, is it called?
Yeah.
I've got a 10-inch blue vinyl. And the Fall do stepping out on that one.
Yeah,
I used to believe everything I read. And fortunately, I mean, I had a friend, a girl that I'd met called Karen Drinkwater. Karen Reed at the time. She was an hairdresser. She's now Karen Drinkwater, but she's the oldest friend in my life. I've known her for longer than anybody else apart from family. And I met her about the same time at the Electric Circus. And she was connected with the Fall. And I think she'd become friends with Carl Burns initially. And she ended up driving the Fall to a lot of gigs. She had a Volkswagen Beetle, and her dad had this Jag that, if he wasn't using it, she borrowed the Jag, and she'd be taking the Fall to these gigs, you know, local, you know, pubs and working men's clubs and some of the earliest gigs. So through Karen, I was invited into the inner sanctum of the first lineup of the Fall.
Wow.
Which, again, you know, at the time and over the years, I've always treasured those memories and valued it. But what an important moment to be part of, to be in that dressing room. I was that quiet kid in the corner, you know. I wasn't a big character, not like I am now. But yeah, it's like, when I think back, it's like, that is surreal that I was in, you know, countless gigs with the Fall backstage, and you know, and it was Carl, it was Una, it was Tony, it was Martin Brammer.
Yeah.
It just a classic. Well, I mean, there's a lot of other classic lineups, obviously. The one that you two were in was a great lineup. But, you know, you know, when I think back, it's like, that's one of the most special things that I've ever been part of, really. You know, that chapter of the Fall's history. Yeah. I remember things like, I remember being at a Tower Club in Oldham. Oh, one of those early gigs. So I'm guessing it might have been late 77, early 78, around that time. Mm. And we're in the dressing room. It's before the Fall had gone on stage.
Well, wasn't the Here and Now one, was it?
It was. Yeah. Supporting Here and Now, the Ippy band. Yeah. And I remember it.
Free in then?
Yeah.
I can't remember. It was free for me because I was with the band.
They only told you that, Clint. It was free for everyone. They were just trying
to make That's me thinking, I'm blagged it in here. But I remember Una had she had a bag of boiled sweets, and she was going around everybody in the dressing room giving them these sweets out, you know, offering us sweets. I thought, that's nice. And I ate it off of Martin from day one. I always love Martin.
Yeah.
Tony, never really got to know because he was very quiet, very introverted. One of, you know, to me, it seemed that way. Carl was a bit too edgy for me, to be honest with you. He put the shits up me a bit. In fact, he gave me a cigarette, but he stubbed his cigarette butt out on my hand one day, which I thought was really out of order, on the back of my hand.
He's only being friendly. It's just his way, you know.
Is that his way of communicating? but I remember,
it's a sign he liked you.
You know, it's his way of bonding, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember, what
you're up, it means he loves you.
You know what? So it's only dawned on me recently about the Fall. In fact, it's only dawned on me since you asked me to do this, that the Fall, you know, throughout all those, is it 60 people that have been in the band in total or something?
Yeah.
Wow. The amount of gentle souls, most of those people, including the lads that were in the Fall right at the end, whenever I've met.
Great people, yeah.
A lot of gentle souls, like Una was, and Martin was, and you know, Riley was, you two are. It's just, it's like, did Mark deliberately surround himself with these gentle souls that he could boss about?
No, he did have a knack of getting sort of great people around him.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it created a great body of work, didn't it? Whatever the chemistry was, he maintained it through fucking decades. And
it's incredible. We've noticed that doing this podcast, everyone we spoke to has been a delight, you know. I mean, including like Kieran from the last lineup, and I know Mark kind of. I don't really know what he said about the earlier lineup. I don't think it was massively complimentary, but it's not something any of them took on board. They weren't like, oh, ambassadors from the early lineup. They didn't subscribe to that at all. They were great and really nice guy.
I think what probably happened was,
imagine like Mark in hotel rooms slagging us off, and then that'd you know, colour their opinion of us, and
yeah,
it hasn't happened.
Yeah, I think from what I can see, being as objective as I can, is that I think by the time you guys joined, there was a kind of understanding of the hierarchy, if I can use that word. Whereas at the beginning, I think there was a bit of a battle, wasn't there, between, was this a cooperative band, or was it Mark's band? And I think when he brought, it was Kay Carroll, wasn't it, that he brought in to manage the band?
Yeah.
Was Kay his girlfriend at the time?
Well, it gets a bit messy, I think, that.
Right.
Because it was Una, and then it's... So yes, I think so. I think she was his girlfriend before she was the manager.
Steve, right. I think that's sort of when I saw things shifting in terms of the the power, if you like, of the control. But I think after that, it became, seeing people getting sacked and coming back in, or leaving of their own accord and then coming back, repeated time. It was obviously a chemistry or an arrangement that worked, yeah, on it. It was painful for some individuals, obviously, along the way, but it worked. If the bottom line was making great albums, making great music, doing amazing gigs, it worked right up until the very end. The last lineup of the Fall that I saw, but with Kieran and the guy, it was just stunning.
Brilliant lineup. So I'll tell you what I was going to ask you. You're talking about the difference between the Fall and other bands and punk. Was it a direct influence on you in terms of keyboards? Because there weren't that many bands with keyboards, were there? Then, and you ended up as a keyboard player.
The Fall, right at the beginning, had the little electronic keyboard, so yeah, I picked up on that and I loved it. Before that, what was into? I mean, I was into 50s rock and roll, so yeah, keyboard music wasn't a big thing for me until the late 70s and through the 80s when I really started getting into the Doors and stuff. But
yeah,
that early electric keyboard that the Fall had, that you
need, that's Snoopy.
Yeah, and then, when Mark Riley and the Creepers, that was like a brilliant keyboard band to me, and that was a massive influence on what I did within Spirals, and I've said that a lot over the years.
I was going to ask about that, because that's that kind of Mark Riley's massive swelling organ, if you'll pardon the expression.
Yeah.
There's a link there, isn't there, I think, between that and in Spirals.
Absolutely, and I've given Mark credit for it over the years. I mean, I think it directly influenced me, when I started within Spirals, because I love the Creepers. I thought they were an amazing band as well.
First time I met you was, I was roadieing for the Creepers.
Really?
Oh, yeah, you were married, was it T'Challa Grid? You were managing a band, is that right?
That's right, yeah, T'Challa Grid from Oldham, yeah.
Yeah, very ahead of the curve in terms of title, Black Panther.
I didn't even know what it meant at the time. It was the bass player, Chris, that had come up with the name, and he tried to explain it to me a couple of times, but I'm like, I don't understand what he's on about here. But it was ahead of its game, wasn't it? Ahead of its time.
Yeah, definitely,
Going back to that keyboard thing and the influence of the Fall on the Inspirals, that song Jaw?
Yeah.
When I wrote Jaw, that was my sort of... I was very influenced by New Face in Hell. Ding 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 ding. That's it. So that was like Joe. Joe was definitely that.
We have noticed. Yeah, I might mention. I might mention the drum pattern at some point. But
yeah, get your people to talk to my people. Yeah.
Millions here, Steve.
What's that?
We're talking millions in compensation here.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I reckon. Yeah, millions.
Well, we would be if I'd had a credit on New Face in Hell, but there you go. That's a different story.
I don't think I have either, have I?
No, I don't know. But there's only so many people you can credit with two notes, really, isn't there?
Yeah. I'll tell you another early memory of the Fall that's a Martin Brammer memory that I love. He was so cool and iconic, wasn't he? The way he used to dress and
he was, like you were saying about Marker, but it's kind of like rock star that's not in any way kind of macho.
Yeah, quite feminine in a lot of ways. And I remember he had this big badge with just an eye, a close-up of an eye on it. I used to desire that badge. I wanted it. But it's one of his party tricks, it took him a while to pull it off, was during one particular song, and I can't remember which song it'd be, but he'd be doing a simple guitar solo, and he'd turn his back to the audience, and then he'd lean over backwards, so he'd be looking at the audience upside down. That was what he was trying to do, if you can picture it. And the first few times he did it, he fell over every time. And then eventually, I should know what venue it was, but eventually he did it. And we were there, me and Karen and the others at the side, and said, like, yay, did it! But yeah, I've never discussed that with him, but I bet he'll remember it. It took a while to get that right, but when he mastered it looks amazing.
Yeah, I'm talking to Martin next week.
Right, brilliant. Ask him about that.
So when he perfected it, he stopped doing it, basically?
Probably moved on to something else or got sacked. I think Martin left of his own accord. Did Martin leave?
I've got to say, it's surprising the number of people, you get this reputation for sacking people, but the number of people who left as opposed to being sacked.
Yeah. Most people.
Sometimes you could view it as constructive dismissal. You know, if your position becomes untenable, you walk before you push. Like, but I think most people, it was their decision. He didn't sack as many people as
And there is that thing you said before, is that a lot of them, most of them, wanted to go back.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. It's amazing when you see that. It's surprising how many did go back. Because it sounds like, you know, that ended ugly, but then he's back here in the next year, you know, doing another album and whatever. Yeah. So, yeah, there was something. There was an attraction, wasn't there? I mean, it was one of the greatest bands of all time. Simple as that. And you know, I
that's it. Yeah. I mean, you're not gonna, you know. Present company accepted. He's one of the finest lyric writers, you know, there's ever going to be, you know. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And I think he always thought that people left saying, I can do better than this. I don't think anybody did, really. Maybe I can do different from this. I want to do a different kind of thing. But I don't think anybody thought, I can write lyrics better than Marky Smith, who left the Four. I really don't believe that.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, he was one of a kind. I cannot think of another lyricist that did what he did. It was just incredible and a joy to listen to. I think I read something recently. John Peel once said that Mark Smith had given more happiness over the years than any other individual, and I think that's something that a lot of us can relate to. That, you know, particularly as a consumer of the music, like I am, you know, rather than somebody in the band, but. The amount of joy it gave me, you know, particularly through those first, you know, 14, 15 albums. And then after that, I lost track a bit. I mean, I got tired of finding out what the new Fall album was. So there's a point where, you know, I've not got the vinyl albums after a certain point.
Yeah.
But, to me, I mean, through the early 80s, when I was working in the furniture trade and just, you know, I had a van, a transit van, and, you know, my life would revolve around, you know, getting the next Fall album, put it on cassette right away, you know, immediately, so I could listen to it wherever I went, and just being obsessed with that music. And, you know, probably more than any other band, how obsessive I became about the Fall. I mean, I did it with the Doors as well a couple of years later, I think, when I think I got into the Doors pretty late. I wasn't into them in the 60s or 70s, but by, you know, the 83, 84, 85, I was obsessed with the Doors. But before that,
they kind of came back then, didn't they? The Doors, they kind of came back into vogue. I don't know, was it No One Here Gets Out Alive? Did that come out then? The documentary,
I think it did. There was a book, and then there was the documentary. I think for me, my trip that led me to the Doors was I'd started collecting all these machines, you know, some instruments, some machines, things that could make music or make noise. That started as soon as punk happened to me. So through, you know, the end of the 70s, the early 80s, I was collecting a lot of machines. And then by 82 or 83, I was working in this mill in Ashton, and I managed to take over a lot of the unused rooms in the mill, and I made a little recording studio and rehearsal studio. And so it meant I could put all these machines out and start a little band. Me and Chris Goodwin and Manny, who ended up in the Roses. Yeah. We started a little band called The Mill at the end of 83.
Right.
And we'd go down to the actual mill every Sunday and make music, record it all on cassettes, which I've still got. Me realizing that I had some keyboards, it was like 60s keyboards. And that's when I started researching bands like The Doors and, you know, the 13th Floor Elevators and The Seeds. These are the incredible 60s bands. I sort of discovered that through the 80s, you know, because of my love of machines and sound, really.
Yeah,
right. And the fact that, I mean, the first instrument I ever got to try and learn was a bass guitar. That was my first instrument, and that'd be about the time of punk. That'd be 76.
You probably mastered that in about 5 minutes, though, didn't you? So it's not.
Yeah.
It hurt my fingers, and I didn't stick at it. I think we had a six string in the house, like an acoustic with. They used to call it cat gut, you know, the plastic strings.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was like, I couldn't get my head around that. Six strings, five fingers. Nah, it's not going to work. But I think that's what led me to the bass. I thought I'd probably be able to, like, smash this because it's only four strings. I've got five fingers on that hand. And it hurt my fingers too much. And so, I mean, ultimately, I gradually moved around to the keyboard. Was the easiest thing for me to get my head around, really. So I think that's how I ended up as a keyboard player, because it's simple. And, you know, because of bands like The Fall and The Creepers, by the time I joined the Inspirals, you could play those nursery rhyme melodies and it was enough. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. But I thought you were like, you'd have been piano lessons as a kid. Looking at you, you're used to hands for a start. So you know you're playing it properly, aren't you?
I don't do much with my left hand. My left hand's mainly chords or simple bass lines. But I think I've got a rhythmic style that I've developed over the years. So a lot of the time, it is, you know, there's a lot of rhythm to what I'm doing rather than scale work. I don't really do scales when I'm playing. But yeah, I mean, I've got a style that people recognise, but I still don't consider myself to be a great keyboard player. And I've really neglected my playing over the last... I've hardly played since Craig died, our drummer. I've hardly played at all, to be honest. I'm still making music, but I'm not really pushing myself as a keyboard player. I see myself more as a singer and a composer, really, than a keyboard player. So, but yeah, it's, I ended up with these amazing machines. I've still got the Farfisa Compact Duo that played all the Inspirals records and gigs.
Does it still work?
Yeah, it's still working. I don't use it much now, obviously, but it's still been, you know, good nick. It still works fine. It's all flight case.
The little Dalek sandbag that sticks out the bottom, the little box, have you still got that as well?
What's that? Sorry,
Kelly had one, and it had this little, like I say, it looked like a Dalek sandbag, and you plugged it in the back of the keyboard, and it sat underneath it.
A power pack, yeah. I'm looking at one here now. Yeah, the Farfisa. it's got a spring reverb inside it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've still got
like
that.
Leslie kind of thing, kind of.
I didn't use a Leslie. The Leslie speaker was, I've got one, but I never used it with the band. It's always a bit too cumbersome. But the good thing with the Farfisa, the vibrato in it was just beautiful. It was like, because it's a transistor instrument and it had this real shrill sort of sound, similar to the Creepers. I don't know what Mark used to use. But
I've got that here. I've got my little reference book here, and he had a CRB Electronica Diamond 600. That's what he had.
Right, so similar sort of thing, transistor instrument, rather than a valve, you know, like the Ammons were valve based, if I remember rightly, and they had a more of a soft sound, you know, whereas we were like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Buddy Ellie did it, but his mouth never played a keyboard. Yeah. That was the exact sound that was.
That's why. That's what I should be doing, making noises with my mouth.
We were searching for that sound with the Lovers for 10 years.
It still sounds now. Like it,
yeah.
So speaking of that, well, what we need to ask you about, of course, is "I Want You." Let's go.
Yeah, amazing.
Whose idea was that to get Mark in? Then was that yours?
I think so. I mean, it was certainly me that got told to make the phone call. So how that came about, you probably remember about the in the early 90s. The big thing for a band was, the way you did it, you'd record your album, 11 songs, and you're going to release 3 or 4 singles from it. So, and the singles back then, to really cane the formats and sell as many units as you could, you'd do a remix. So you'd release "This Is How It Feels."
We didn't know anything about that with Hit the North.
Jesus Christ.
So, did it happen with Hit the North?
There's about 25 remixes.
Yeah. So that's the way it was. What was that? Was that 85? 80? Yeah.
A bit later than that one.
86. Yeah. So that's what bands did. I mean, on the advice of the record label, you'd release the single on 3 formats. It'd be 7-inch, 12-inch cassette. Mm. And then you'd release a remix the week after. There'd be a remix by somebody on our label, Mute Records. It might be, you know, somebody out of Depeche Mode remix. And then that'd come out on 7-inch, 12-inch and cassette. So you'd have all these formats. It was normal to do it, but I think we always found it a bit
distasteful, really.
Yeah, distasteful, a bit brutal.
Trying to get the same people to buy it over and over again.
Yeah, and also the quality of some of the remixes was shite. I mean, some of them are brilliant. You know, there's
some of them Hit the North remixes that none of the band are on.
Yeah, absolutely. We had that. I mean, the best one we had was, I think it was "She Comes in the Fall," the single, where one of the remixes that we had done through the record company was done by Rebel MC, right? Oh, yeah. Remember that? He had a big hit record. I can't remember what it's called. Ding, 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 ding. So this remix comes back and we're all sat there in the office in Manchester, put it on, play it. And it was like, is that ding, 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 ding. She comes in the fall. It was like, are you joking? He wants $3,000. Well, so we went through that era. You know, we played the game, we did all that. But by the time we had that album, what album was "I Want You" on? Was that the last? Was it "Revenge of the Goldfish"?
Was I
the
think one it
after?
Was, yeah.
Or it might have been "Devil Up." Anyway, whatever album it was, we decided that the singles that we're going to release from it, rather than just doing remixes, we'd do some collaborations with other artists that we could use instead of remixes, you know. So we did one with Peter Hook. Peter Hook did a track with us. In fact, we called it Theme from Devil Hopping. So it was the Devil Hopping album period.
Right.
Hookie did that. We did a track with Basil Clark that was brilliant.
The guy from Yago.
Yeah, I Don't Want to Go Blind was the name of the track. So we had our version on the album, and then we had a version with Basil singing it. And somehow we came up with the idea of approaching Smithy to do a track or two tracks. I can't remember whether I suggested it, but I knew Mark. I'd bumped into him a lot of times around Manchester. He was in the same building, I think, at one point. I think, did the Fall have an office in?
We did.
In New Mount Street, was it?
Yeah.
So I'd see Mark, and he was always...
in New Mount Street, weren't you? Yeah.
Yeah, and he was always dead complimentary, because I'd seen, you know, you'd see him in the papers slagging everybody in the world off, and particularly musicians, and... He was the one that, one of my favourite Mark stories was when he was in the NME office at some point and he saw a picture of the Verve on somebody's desk, and it was before the Verve were established, and he looked at this picture and he said, "I hope we never have a war."
Yeah. There's a great one with Suede, where Suede was supporting him, and he came on and they didn't think they were going to get a sound check, and Mark came out and said, "No, give these lads a sound check. They sound really good, these." And he stood there and he watched the sound check, and then he was interviewed the same day on the radio, and they said, "Oh, what do you think of Suede?" Never heard of him.
Brilliant. Anyway, so I'd bump into him and he was always dead complimentary. And I think because he recognised we're a 60s influenced garage band, he saw the seeds in what we were doing, and he saw the question mark and the Mysterians and all these bands that he'd really appreciate. So he was always dead complimentary. He'd always give me the time of day. "How was that band you was going, Clint? Are they doing all right? Yeah, look all right, you know. You should do it for a living, you know. You might make some money out of that if you keep doing it." And so he was always dead complimentary. So we decided we were going to ask him to do some collaborative work with us on this album. And I phoned him up, and he was in an hotel somewhere. I can't remember where it was, but... I phoned him and he said, "Yeah, I'll do that. Send me the album. I'll listen to it." And we sent it to him, and he picked two tracks. He said, "I'll do Saturn 5 and I Want You." And we're like, "Fucking hell, brilliant! This is it." So I mean, the Saturn 5 version didn't come out until a few years ago. Released it as a special edition on some great.
Yeah, it's pretty good actually.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Yeah. But the I Want You. We ended up putting it out as a single and subsequently doing Top of the Pops and all this.
We're going to have to get Steve on that. He's got over it now, but the only time Marquis Whipper's on Top of the Pops with the Inspiro Carpets. And
absolutely, yeah. It was funny because that period was... I mentioned to Paul the other day when I was talking that I only spent a matter of days working with Mark, but I feel like I could write a book about it. So yeah. for you guys that were in there for, you know, fucking years and years, I mean, you were...
We have written a book about it.
You have, yeah. But it's like, but it's so intense and colourful, fucking very colourful, but very intense and frightening at some moments, you know. But that period of doing the recording, which we did at Parr Street, Top of the Pops, you know, the trip to London to Top of the Pops, the press days that we did with it, photo shoots, video shoots, all that era... Me working that closely with him, you know, to me was like, fucking hell, this was the guy that, when I first saw him at the circus in 77, the last night, the Electric Circus, he knocked Elvis Presley off the plinth of, you know, my favourite pop star, became Mark Smith. So I was that obsessive about the Fall back then. If I'd have ever known, if somebody had told me you're going to end up doing fucking Top of the Pops with him, recording with him, being his mate, you know, it's like, I wouldn't have believed it. And there we were. But the Top of the Pops trip...
I think it was Graham who said it, wasn't it, about what a great job Tom did on that Top of the Pops, because he was singing live and Mark was just coming in whenever he felt like it.
Yeah, and it changed every time. I mean, through the course of the day, when we were doing the run-throughs, the camera run-throughs that you do, because you go through it like six or seven times through the course of the afternoon, and it's so that the cameraman can practice where they're going to, you know, film at each moment. And those shit close-ups of
the bass player when it's a guitar solo.
I was going to say exactly that. He used to piss me off that. It's like you're watching Top of the Pops, and like, hang on, I'm doing my fucking guitar solo, and you're seeing Craig's bass drum here. Keyboard solo. And anyway, so they did all this, and so the cameramen and crew were very precious about, this has got to be right, it's like military precision. And then you bring someone like Mark Smith into the equation. So Mark was doing it differently. Every run through the afternoon, he'd be in a different part of the stage, he'd be singing different words, he'd be you know, one minute he'd have his arm around Tom and the next minute he'd be stood behind the drums, whatever, like he does, and fiddling with amps, like that annoying thing that he used to do.
But slightly less annoying when you're miming.
Yeah, probably. But
carry on, Mark.
So hey, we'll come back to Top of the Pops in a minute. So when he did that, right, when he played with, like, I'm assuming, Steve, that he messed with your bass amp, did he, while you were playing?
I'm going to say I was probably the first person he ever did it to.
Right, and did he actually do anything, or was he just, like...
Yeah, he did, yeah. I was in this gig in Australia, and we had a big row about it afterwards.
Right. And then he just carried on doing it.
Well, no, from that, if you see me from then on, I'm stood in right in front of my bass amp.
So he can't get to it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a revelation. I'll start with that.
Simon was saying they had a fake bass drum mic.
Yeah.
So that he could pull that out and launch it across the stage and they'd still have a bass drum mic. The real one would still be in there.
Oh, so a bit of theatre.
Yeah. No, he didn't know. He thought it was real.
That's right.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. Oh, anyway, back to Top of the Pops. So it was through the afternoon, he's causing havoc. And then we got a call. Me and Graham got called by our plugger before the live run through. And we got called to the side of the, there's like a little alleyway behind the studio, like a fire escape and an alleyway. And we stood there, me, Graham, Nicky Kefalos, our plugger. And the producer of Top of the Pops at the time, I'm not going to name him now because it's led to disagreements in the past, this, but he said, you're going to have to send Mark home. We don't want you to do this with Mark. He's causing too much friction in the crew. And we're like, you what? We're doing it with Mark, or we're not doing it. The previous visit to Top of the Pops, whatever single that was, when we told them we were thinking of putting the track with Mark out as a single, the Top of the Pops producer was like, you've got to get him on Top of the Pops. You've got to get him on Top of the Pops. And I'm like, are you sure? Yeah, you've got. And we did. We got him down there. And then there they are telling us to get rid of him. Blimey. So it's like we dug our heels and we said, that if, you know, if Mark's not doing it, we're not doing it. Simple as that. Anyway, we did it. And it was beautiful. It was spectacular. In terms of Top of the Pops history for, you know, thousands of people like us that appreciate, you know, good music. That was an absolute highlight on top of that, wasn't it? But going down to do the live, you've probably heard this story, going down from the green room or the dressing room to the studio to film the live performance. Mark, he used to get himself really wound up into a weird character before he went on stage a lot of time, didn't he? He'd be like... locking himself away in toilets and, you know, just really getting in. I don't know whether it's part of his routine, but he did this at Top of the Pops and he ended up in a really weird mood as we're walking down to do it. And he stopped me on the stairs, me and him walking down side by side, and he stopped me on the stairs. He said, Clint, look at me. Are you all right? I'm fine. Look at me. And he slapped me across the face. So I slapped him back. And then he slapped me. We were like slapping each other like maybe fucking Laurel and Hardy or something. And then he stubbed his... he stubbed his cigarette out on my shirt. I had a real beautiful denim shirt with an Harley Davidson bike embroidered across the front. And he stubbed it out right on the cylinder head of the embroidery.
Bloody hell, it could have blown up like...
Yay! But it was only a piece of clothing. No, but he did that. In fact, I think he did that before the slapping started. Anyway, but either way, we're there on the stairs on our way to this live, you know, this iconic live performance. And me and my all-time musical hero are slapping each other. Wow. Slapping fuck out of each other's faces. It's like, what's going on? Anyway, the rest of the band, like, sort of broke it up and, it moved on. No malice whatsoever. We got on stage and it was brilliant. And he was, I think as part of his ad-libbed rant on the performance, he's talking about me in the rant.
Yes, I saw that. He said something about you, didn't he?
It's like, and there's Clinton, he's in love. I want you back.
Yeah.
So, it was just that weird moment of slapping. I mean, you know what? It wasn't like we weren't trying to kill each other or hurt each other. It was just grown blokes who should know better slapping each other.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I've experienced that myself, to be honest. Yeah. That's a different story. There's a great bit in the video when he says, the Inspiral Carpets is trying to be like the Seeds, but no one's ever heard of them either.
Yeah. he told a joke as well about, we had to cut it out of the video, but he did a joke about, and I think it was about a plane load of Americans crashing or something. It was like, it was a bit dark, so we took that out because we thought we don't want to end up with anything controversial happening. But just every day with him was, like that, as you know, and I don't know how you did that for years, year after year after year. I don't know, but yeah, well done. Congratulations to you both. You win.
It only took him 5 years to get over it.
Yeah, I did. He did something we made later on in life, which was totally spontaneous and, you know, again, equally as brilliant for me as a moment in my career. So I had a band called the Clint Boone Experience.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, yeah.
Yeah, and we did, I was doing a gig in London. I can't remember the venue, but we came off stage, if I remember rightly, and my manager, Spike, said, oh, Mark Smith's out here. He wants to come and say hello to you. This is before we did the encore. And he brought him in. He brought him into the dressing room. We had a little catch up. He said, fucking great to see you, Clint. And he said, do you want me to come on stage and do anything with you? He offered it to us. And I said, well, that'd be fucking brilliant. You know, but I don't know what we could do. We could not rehearse that. I said, we always finish our set. We always do the encore. I Want to Be Your Dog by the Stooges. And he said, I'll do that. Well, let's do that then. Come on, let's do that. Let's get on. Come on. And he just did this. And it was recorded. You know, we had a nice recording of it. And it totally totally, you know, spontaneous. Unrehearsed, and it was brilliant. And
you released that, didn't you? I think
it came out as a B-side of a single, and it's on YouTube. It's actually on YouTube. But again, for me, you know, as one of my favourite moments in my career and life, that'd be it. You know, him getting up doing that unannounced, unpracticed. It just
I was going to ask about that album. That album's got Mark Frau Neely out of Travis.
Yeah,
and Alfie Ball. That's right. Isn't it?
Alfie Ball, the opera singer.
Yeah. That's quite
a lineup,
isn't it?
Yeah, that Alfie chapter was nice. That was when the Inspirals had split. We split in spring '95, and I started working on a lot of other projects, including solo music. And during that time, I met this unknown opera singer from Fleetwood, and we decided to do some work together because I was really into doing. I think when it came out of the Inspirals, then my mindset was I want to do stuff that I couldn't have done in the Inspirals.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's unbridled and, you know, no boundaries. And that's what the Clint Boone Experience was. It was like, in a lot of ways, it was just this mad cabaret band at a time when people weren't doing stuff like that. You know, it was a mad show. You know, we had like a guy playing tuba on stage. We had a life-size cardboard cutout of me left over from the Inspirals photo shoots, and had a reindeer's head on the front of the Far Fizer. It still had the bullet hole in its head where it had been killed by a hunter or whatever. It was like, this all this bizarre stuff going on. Not that I condoned that hunting, but it was my mum and dad's reindeer. They had it on the lounge wall like you did in the 1970s, and they give it me, and so I can put it on my organ because it's a cabaret band. So it's all this mad stuff. Anyway, but yeah, Alfie Ball, this opera singer, I got him over to my studio in my house in Rochdale. And as I said, he was unknown at the time. He'd just finished working for TVR, which is where he was spraying cars for a living. And he was about to go off to study opera at the opera college. And we recorded a load of stuff in my house, which became, it was spread out over the two Clint Boone Experience albums. And he's just got such an amazing voice. Even back then, you knew that this guy was special, you know, for a young chap to have a voice like that. And he did gigs with us when he was available. He'd come and get on stage and do the songs with us. And we always dressed him up in an evening suit and put sunglasses on him. And we called him Opera Dude. That was his name on stage. We'd welcome him. And he just went down a treat. Every time he did it, it was just amazing, you know. And then the gigs that Alfie couldn't do, we had a girl called Sarah Cluderay that was, she was opera chick since she became our opera singer later on. But yeah, that was a nice, that chapter of being just able to do whatever I wanted, you know, all these mad ideas without having to sell the ideas to my mates in the Inspirals.
Yeah.
Just get it out of my system while I could, and I did, and it led to some really lovely collaborations. I mean, the thing with Fran Ealer was beautiful, and just dead lucky that I could keep that live music thing going and that recording music thing going, because it was an hard time, that 95, 96 for me. I was on my arse. I was signing on for the first part of that period because I think my second child had just been born at that point. And, you know, all the money that the Inspirals had made through the glory years, as Tom calls it, was sort of running out. You know, we all had big mortgages and, you know, some of us had fancy cars and all that bullshit.
Yeah.
So the money was running out and I had kids to feed and a mortgage to pay. And it was, you know, for me, fortunately, we lived in a country where I was able to get help with my mortgage and, you know, the income support to help me with the kids and all that. So I made the most of that, and, you know, while I needed it. But during that time, I made some of my best work, I think, you know, creatively. Yeah. Some of the songs that I wrote for the Clint Boone Experience is definitely some of my best work, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was during that time that I got the call from Mark, wasn't it, where he asked me to join the Fall, which is...
For what year would that have been?
What year are we talking about?
It'd either be late 95 or early 96. I've still got the micro cassette somewhere with the message on it.
Right, so you were still in the band then, Steve?
I was still in the band then, yeah. Right. I've been trying to recollect being, you know, asked about it or consulted.
I think it was before Julia joined, wasn't it? So when did Julia join? Can you remember that?
Yeah, that was probably, late 95.
Yeah, so before that then he called me. I was his first choice. I've got a feeling he either asked me before Julia joined or just after, but I've got a feeling it might have been just before. Anyway, he left me a message on my answer form, and it was, Clint, I need a new keyboard player for the Fall, and I think you're the man for it, so give us a call and we'll sort it out. You know, like just assuming I was going to snap his hand off, which part of me wanted to. Anyway, I phoned him back and I said, I'm flattered, Mark, but I'm just really busy at the moment. I've just got so much on. I could have done it. I told the man a lie, but it was only because having seen how uncomfortable working with him could be at some points.
I think you made the right decision. Probably.
Yeah, I didn't want to join a band, you know, and you know, have a great year with him, 2 years with you, and then fall out with him. You know, it's one of them. It's my hero, my musical hero, one of them. You know, alongside people like Elvis and Philip Glass. You know, Smith was up there with them, and I just thought I don't want to be fighting with him. I don't want him unplugging my keyboard during the gig. I don't want him slapping me. You know, it's like I'd rather keep it that we were mates and, you know, we collaborate occasionally, hopefully. And I told him, I just said, I can't do it. And I told him a white lie, but I think we probably did each of us a favour by doing that.
He said that as well. Ed Blaney, he did the same thing. He worked with Mark off and on for years, and he always made it a thing that he was never going to join the Fall because he knew it had changed the relationship, you know.
Really, yeah. And Ed was never actually in the Fall, was he? I don't think.
He wasn't,
right.
No.
Right.
I mean, he was mates with Mark right to the end, so it changes the relationship, doesn't it? You know, not saying that's necessarily Mark's fault or anybody else's, but it does. It's different, isn't it?
Well,
yeah.
It is tough to balance that, somebody who's your friend and your boss sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally, yeah. And I think I recognise that.
As extreme as Mark.
Yeah. Part of me, you know, part of me wishes I could have had that parallel life where I could have done it and tasted it and been on some of those amazing records. I think I made the right, but, you know, bear in mind that there probably is only this one life that we get, that I think I did the right thing, really.
Especially around 95 and 96.
Yeah, then, if it had been earlier or later, it might have been...
Yeah,
but at that time, I think you did the right thing.
Yeah, I like it as well that we remained good friends, and you know, there was a lot of mutual respect right up until the last time I saw him, which was, we did a gig in Italy. There was a festival out in Italy. I think it was 2014 we did it. And we were the headline act. And I've said this before in interviews, that when we arrived at the gig, because I wasn't sure where we were playing and who was on the bill, and it was the Buzzcocks opening up, and then it was the Fall, and then it was us in Spirals. And I remember saying to him, that poster's upside down, surely it should be the other way up. You know, because in my mind, it's like, without those two support bands, that headline band wouldn't have existed. It was as simple as that. And it was a brilliant occasion to be at, and we've got some real nice photographs. I'm not getting pictures of me and Mark at that event, but me and, like, Pete Shelley was another one of my heroes, you know.
Yeah, totally. Mine too, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember I've met Pete a few times over the years, but nothing, you know, we never became close friends or spent any quality time together, but it was always a hero. I remember getting off the plane at the airport, and it was near Venice, this festival, and as we got our bags and walked through to the arrivals lounge, and Pete Shelley there was a man there, stood there with a clipboard saying "In Spiral Carpets," and then Pete Shelley popped out and, "Hello, Clint, how are you doing?" I'm like, fucking hell, another one of my musical heroes here, just fucking letting on to me. And then me and him sat side by side in this minibus going to the hotel, just getting all these stories out of him about the past, and, you know, just like getting him to reminisce. And but anyway, I met Mark at that gig. So we arrived on site, and the dressing rooms were, it was like an outside gig in the middle of a town, and the dressing rooms were in some civic building, whatever. And I think just before Buzzcocks came on, Mark arrived in the dressing rooms, and I went in to see him, and we're having a chat. And he said, "So who's playing?" And I said, "Well, Buzzcocks are about to come on stage now, and then it's you." Like, I said, "Oh, I like Buzzcocks. Let's go and watch them." And so we're going out to watch this band like 30 yards from where we're standing. So he picks up all his carrier bags and walks out. Like, but we just stood watching Buzzcocks. It was just like, it just he was like so what's the word, lucid and, you know,
yeah,
funny, charming. It was just, I think it's probably the best I've ever seen him over the years. And we watched the Buzzcocks together, and that was the last time I saw him that night.
Right.
So I like it that my last memory of him is that.
Definitely, yeah.
Rather than one, yeah, you know, many, many years ago, I can't remember where he was, it was some party, some fall launch party that I'd been invited to as his mate, and I went over to see him. So, are you having a good night, Mark? Everything all right? Like, Clint, fuck off. You know what I mean? That's how he could be, innit? Just no reason whatsoever. He'd just, you know, completely blow you out, which he did that night. And I would think that's the only time I can remember him being nasty to me, apart from the slapping incident at Toffee, which wasn't even that nasty. Really, just too
he was slapping you in a kind way there, wasn't he? Let's face it.
Yeah, yeah. The top of the pops one was, I think in his mind, slapping me was probably getting me to wake up, get on, you know, get my senses. He was probably thinking that's psyching me up, but it was actually it's just bizarre.
Don't make it okay, but you kind of explained it. So I was going to ask you about these spirals, because obviously you got back together and then, tragic reasons, you had to knock it on the head. So where are things with the Inspirals these days then?
We're still a business. We're still doing stuff, you know, all the time. There's stuff going on to do with like reissuing records or, you know, Such a Body wants to use this track on a compilation album. So the conversations there, we're very much a business. We've not decided to split up or anything. That discussion hasn't happened. But since Craig died, there's just not been any talk whatsoever about getting back out there and doing it live.
Yeah.
I'm sure that at some point that discussion or that conversation will happen, but it's not happening yet. Right. Now, having said all that, tonight, you know, this the night that we're recording this, we're actually doing a Tim's Twitter listening party.
Yeah, you're doing a few, aren't you?
Yeah, we're doing two. We're doing one tonight and then one next Wednesday. We're doing the albums that came out in 92 and 93. So tonight is Revenge of the Goldfish and next week is Devil Hopping. So when you do these things, you know, traditionally it creates a lot of love and positivity about the band and the record. Yeah. So I think it'll be as a result of something like what's happening tonight, somebody might just say, who fancies doing something live? And it might happen. Now, for me personally, when that decision is made, it's a lot of work for me, because it's months of sorting out the equipment again, because it's a lot of keyboards, technology and stuff. And then you've got the endless rehearsal, trying to remember the song. So it's a big process for me to say yes. Yeah, I'm ready to do Inspirals. And at the moment, I've got so many other things on in my schedule that I'm not ready for it yet. I feel like if I'm going to do it with the Inspirals, I need to say, let's start working on it in 6 months' time so I can clear the decks. And I've not discounted ever doing it again.
Would you all feel all right about doing it, if you don't mind me asking, do you think?
It's hard for me to say, isn't it? You know what? I mean, in my ideal, I'm very Mr. Positive and, you know, idyllic in my outlook. I'd say let's do it with, you know, everybody, Steve and Tom. Let's get both singers involved. You know what I mean? Right. It's like that'd be my take on it. That might get blown out of the water as soon as I suggested it. But that, you know, to me, I think it'd be a beautiful way to, you know, it's a shame if the last chapter is the one that ended with Craig dying.
Yes,
I'd love it if the last chapter was us celebrating the complete. You know, get some of the other members in that have helped us over the years, and you know, definitely. Tom is still a massive part of it. So whether that'll happen, I don't know. It might not have a chance in hell of happening. But, you know, in my mind, I'm still thinking along those terms that something should happen at some point.
Yeah. You were going to ask something about Inspirals, weren't you, Steve?
What? Oh, yeah. We played with Tom for 10 years.
Yeah.
And so how did you feel about us playing Inspiral songs?
I was jealous of the fact that he had two of the Fall in his band. How the fuck has he done that?
I still don't know that myself.
You know what? It's like, I've never had a problem with that, mate. I've never had a problem with Tom doing our songs. I've never had a problem with, I do a lot of work with tribute bands. You've probably seen that. I do a lot of DJing at tribute band events. Yeah. And I've never had a problem with that, really, because it's a case of celebrating great songs and great bands. Often.
Oh, we used to really enjoy playing them songs, didn't we?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
We did that tour where we did the complete Beast Inside.
Yeah.
That's great. That's a great album.
It's a funny album, because it still get when I've been looking through old press recently, because as part of trying to sort my house out with all this stuff that I've got hoarded, I've been going through old copies of NME and Melody Maker and Sounds, and where I've saved a full copy of the paper, you know, for just a little live review, I've started just cutting out the bits that are relevant and bringing the rest. So I've been reading through some of the old press that we've got, and it's funny how cruel the press were about us, particularly during that Beast Inside period.
Right.
Because before that, we were never considered to be as cool as the rest of Manchester scene.
No, you got a bit of a tough ride, really, didn't
you?
Yeah,
we did.
That Manchester thing.
Yeah, but we had the hits early on that they couldn't ignore that. And so we got some good press in the early, for the first album, Live. But with Beast Inside, when I'm reading back now some of the reviews for it, and they hated us, and they hated that album. And a lot of people talked about it as being a flop. I've seen like some of the faxes that we used to get sent to the office about the follow-up album to Beast Inside, which was Revenge of the Goldfish.
Yeah.
And people talking really negatively within the industry about we're hoping this album's going to be better after the Beast Inside episode. Da-da-da-da-da. Beast Inside got to number 5 in the album charts in the UK. It got to number 5. It sold a lot of copies around the world.
Yeah.
It was, and it's like, in terms of how kind history's been to it, you couldn't have a better fairy tale, because people recognise now what a genius bit of work, but what an incredibly mature piece of work that was, that record, you know, for a band at that stage of its career. We often said ourselves, we joked about the fact that we probably made our 5th album a bit early. You know what I mean? Our second album probably should have been our 5th album, but it's a great album, Beast Inside. I'm dead proud of it.
It's a proper album as well, isn't it? You know, because we played the whole thing in the order it's on, and it's a proper piece. It's not just like 10 songs. It's an album, isn't it? It's a proper album.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and it's an album that's not scared of. We weren't thinking singles here. We were writing these monumental tracks that were just. Yeah. Couldn't have been singles, but they were just as part of an album. It's a really nice journey, I think, when you listen to it.
Definitely.
And we reissued Beast Inside recently, and we included one extra track, which was Niagara, it's something that we'd only released as a B side originally.
Right, because Niagara's on the album, isn't it?
Niagara's on the album. But we stuck another tune in before it, because this tune that we recorded is a B side. As we finished the recording, as I finished recording the keyboards, I started playing the keyboard line for a new idea we were working on, which became Niagara, if I remember rightly. So we put this track in position, like in the position on the album where it would have been if we'd have included it in the first line. I should know the title of the track, but completely forgot it. But yeah, great album. And the closing track, Dreams Are All We Have, on Beast Inside, was recorded... After we did all the recording down at, it might have been Jacob's studio in London, down south. I think it was Jacob. But we came back to Strawberry to mix it all with Nagel.
Chris Nagel.
I got my Nagels mixed up then. I was going to say Julian. I had all my keyboards set up in the studio. I'd just been playing this tune, this mad instrumental. It was like very much influenced by Twin Peaks and that Angelo Badalamenti music.
Yeah. I was going to say, it sounds like it's the soundtrack to a film that never came out.
Yeah. Well, we recorded it. It's a live take. I set all my keyboards up Rick Wakeman style. I'd never compare myself to Rick Wakeman, but that was how it was. It was a lot of keyboards. And I just played it all in one take.
Really?
Record it. It's still onto multi-track, all the different sounds. And then I think we added a bit of drums, maybe timpani or something over the end of it, towards the end. But that was recorded totally in Strawberry Studios, that track. I think before that, we'd never recorded a complete track in Strawberry. We'd just done bits of tracking and mixing in there. But yeah, it's funny. I live in Stockport. I drive past Strawberry most days, and I still reminisce not just about the music we made in there, but the some of the iconic stuff.
I can give you 3 hours on Strawberry and how important it is. But
I did the other day. There's proper train spotter, right? So we all know the story about Martin Annett using the lift shaft to create the reverb on Joy Division's early recordings.
Yeah.
So the other day, and I knew I've known this for years since when we used to work there, I'd know about this lift shaft, but I've never gone looking for the lift shaft. And the other day, about 3 weeks ago, on my way through Stockport, I drove around the back of Strawberry, got out of my car, and just looked at the lift shaft and photographed it. You can see it from the back street.
Yeah.
And you're just looking at the biggest echo chamber ever made, and it's like, well, not the biggest, but the most important. It's just there to be seen, and it needs a blue plaque on the back of the studio, I think, as well.
Well, have you ever done the Motown tour in Detroit? Because it's just a house.
Right, I've never done it.
No, it's really good. I mean, it's a couple of hours, but in there, there's like a skylight. and it's just like a hole in the ceiling that goes up to the roof.
Yeah.
You go around the tour and he goes and he gets everybody in to stand under this, and then you clap your hands and this massive reverb. That's what all the reverb on the Motown track is, just this hole in the ceiling.
Wow. How deep is it then?
Two floors up, this hole.
Amazing. And it's like a cylindrical.
Yeah, it's like a chimney almost in a way.
Right.
That's what he said. All those hand claps that you hear on Motown records, it's a real thing. It's not an effect, or something they put on the desk. It's really there.
It's funny. I mean, I've never done the Motown tour. I'm a big Elvis fan, as I mentioned earlier. I've never been to Graceland.
You've never been to Graceland?
Just never had the opportunity. I mean, like on my travels with the band, I mean, me and Graham traditionally nip off and do a bit of sightseeing. You like went to the Kennedy, where Kennedy got shot.
Yeah.
The Grassy Knoll. We went there as soon as we arrived in Dallas.
Well, the Grassy Knoll Gallagher, didn't you?
We did that. Say again.
I said you went to the Grassy Knoll with Grassy Knoll Gallagher.
Yeah, Grassy Knoll. Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was a grass joke then, to do with smoking weed, which he used to do a lot of. We did a bit of sightseeing on our travels, but never made it to Graceland or the Motown Museum.
And the other one there, of course, if you're in Detroit, if you're ever in Memphis, is the Sun Studios. That's amazing.
Again, never been there yet, but it gives me something to look forward to next time I get a successful pop group together.
you can go without a band, you know. You're allowed to go.
Can't afford it, mate. I'm behind with my tax now. After that pandemic, I'm right behind with my tax.
That was brilliant, that Clint. That was really, really good. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you too, as well. I know it's a privilege, speaking to you both. Absolutely privileged.
No, brilliant. And take care of yourself. And I hope we'll speak again. I'm sure we could get another 3 hours out of this if you really wanted to.
Yeah, you know, if you want to do a follow up at some point, just we'd have to go on. I'd try and not repeat myself, but there's so much to talk about. You know what? One of the things I've not talked about, and you can cut this into the interview or just leave it here if you want, but with the Four, more than any other band that I can think of, that did they do like 30 studio albums, 31?
30. There's a bit of to and fro in about what constitutes a studio album and stuff as well. But
I collected probably the first half of those up to album. Infotainment, Scam, Middle Class Revolt, that sort of era, that even up to albums 10, 11, 12, they were still recording and releasing like career-defining tunes or certainly style, you know, Fall classics. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like on Curious Orange, it was Big New Prince.
Yeah.
It the North came well into the... Was it Friends Experiment? Was number album 9 or 10? So it wasn't just like the first couple of albums had some great tunes on it and then they got a bit shit. It was like well into the release schedule. They were putting out, you know, genre-defining tunes.
Yeah.
And I know James are good at that as well, because James stick to promoting the new music and not just relying on it. So James is still releasing records 2 or 3 years ago, that James classics, like Moving On is a beautiful tune by James. And I think... I can't think of another band that do what the Fall have done over the years. That, you know, they just kept coming out with these greatest Fall songs ever, you know what I mean, after album 12 or whatever.
I mean, depending on who you talk to, you know, you'll get plenty of people argue that even up until the last albums, they were still as vital and as important as any Fall album ever was, which is, again, there's very few artists you can say that about.
Absolutely.
If any.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing about James is, which I always think is brave, it's all very well for the Fall and you're playing a club and you're not playing any old stuff, but they play festivals and they still refuse to do sit down.
And they're still brilliant. They're just always brilliant. And you know, like even the last album, they released an album just after the pandemic or towards the end of it, and just some of the best music they've ever made, and it's like incredible. So
I can't think of the title of it. Have you seen the one with the video where it's the ball of wool and it's
Moving On, it's called.
That's
Moving On.
Brilliant, that song.
Yeah. And I think he wrote it about, it's either about his mum dying or it's a very close family member.
I think it is his mum, yeah.
Yeah, and the video alone makes you cry, doesn't it?
Killer, that video.
Yeah.
Right, well, on that bombshell. Okay.
Brilliant, right. I'll leave you both to it. No doubt see you soon for a drink at some point.
Let's do it, yeah. Brilliant.
And thanks for having me. Absolute pleasure.
You're very welcome. Thanks again.
Thank you. All right, guys.
Good night, God bless.
Bye.
Yeah, man.
Thanks for joining us on episode 10 of series 2 of Old Brother. Episodes are released every second Monday, so watch your episode 11 in 2 weeks' time. Please follow us on Twitter at Old Brother Show. You can find a link to Spotify, subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, give us a rating on iTunes. Subscribe on the YouTubes or just tell your friends. For further reading, you can check out our books about the fall, Big Midweek and How We're Bleeding Guests from Root Publishers and all good bookstores. Hope to speak to you all again soon. And remember, if you're driving, take your car. Ta-da.